Hi, y'all. I'm Courtney. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Courtney.
Everybody hear me okay? All right. So, thanks, Sam, for asking me to come share. I don't know who told you to ask me, but I almost had to write inventory on them. But, you know, it's funny, when I was newly sober, I got sober in 2007, August 2nd, to be exact. I would have loved to have been asked to share. You know, I could have done this all day long, and the longer I've been sober, the less I want to do it, and I don't know. I was thinking today, is it that my ego is, like, getting more right-sized, or is it just, like, kind of shape-shifting into now I don't think I'm all that, and it's, like, the opposite, you know? I don't think I'm, you know, this big hotshot, wonderfully witty, eloquent speaker, and so, you know, therefore, if I can't be perfect at it, I don't want to do it, because that's definitely one of my personality traits. You know, this is good for me. I need to do it, and I was told that this is a warm, welcoming, inviting home group, and so far, you know, it seems to be. So it looks like you guys have all been sober forever. I don't know. Is there anybody with less than 90 days in the room? Awesome. Okay. Well, then, hopefully, you know, you'll get something out of this. I don't pretend to have this great wisdom or knowledge about how this thing works and all, but all I have is my experience and, you know, what I used to be like and what happened to me to make me decide to come to AA and try to get sober, and then what I'm like today, which is a work in progress. So, as I said, August 2nd, 2007 is my sobriety date. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other women, and my home group is the Jaywalkers group that meets at Bon Air Presbyterian in Richmond on Tuesdays and Fridays at 7 o'clock, and I think I've seen you there before. You spoke one time. And you had to go to Talbot's. Was that you? I remember that story because in our business meeting, some people decided we were going to enact this dress code for our speakers, and I was so against it. And I caught that you were a little bit too, and I was like, yes, see, I was right. We can't be telling people what to do. I got sober in West Virginia in a tiny little middle of nowhere place called Scrabble, West Virginia. You're familiar, and you really had to be desperate and willing to go to that meeting because it was out this series of like winding back country roads, and there was nothing in Scrabble but this one room, tiny ancient church where we had our meeting in, maybe a handful of houses. That comes along later. I'll just say that I grew up in Charleston, West Virginia. I come from a good home, stable, loving home. My parents, you know, they gave us everything we needed. We were loved, and we were taught right from wrong. I had a younger brother. He turned out great. He's a firefighter and a paramedic, so he, like, saves lives for a living. And then I turned out to be an alcoholic. And you know, I had a happy childhood, actually. I didn't grow up feeling, somehow off. And I know that's a lot of people's experience. I'm sure that I had, you know, the self-centeredness in the extreme, but I never... But I was happy for the most part. We moved to a somewhat nicer, more upscale neighborhood, still middle class, when I was right at that perfect age for starting to get real self-conscious, 14-ish, you know, teen angst was setting in, and I really wanted to fit in and make new friends, and maybe a normal person would have thought to, like, join a club or try out for a sport, but I don't want to do anything that requires work and practice. So I saw that, the coolest kids, they partied a lot. And I figured that wouldn't take much effort, you know, because how much practice does it take to put a bottle to your lips or, you know, a cigarette to your mouth or a joint or whatever it was. And so that was the path I decided to take, you know, to get in good with folks and have friends and rise to the top. So the July 1990, actually, I drank for exactly 17 years, July 1990 to July 2007. It was the summer before ninth grade, and I snuck out of my parents' house, and I was a good kid up until then. You know, I didn't do stuff like that. I snuck out and met up with these two boys from school, and they had some liquor like that they had put in mason jars, which I think is so perfectly West Virginian. And I don't even know what it was, but it was exactly the right amount to get the three of us just the perfect amount of drunk. You know, not too much, not too little, like the perfect blissful state that we always strive for. And that was my first experience with alcohol, and I loved it. I loved, you know, I immediately got that sense of conviviality and the effect that, you know, we like, that it produces, camaraderie with them, and this feeling, you know, that everything was awesome and funny and wonderful, and I was too, and life was just grand and beautiful, and you know, it was something that I definitely wanted to do again. And I also had my first kiss that night, and I remember I got a big hickey. And the next day, and I was so proud of that hickey. The next day, I went like bebopping down my street in my neighborhood to my friend's house to carry this message to her if she would have it as well. And I was wearing my shorts and my turtleneck in July. And, you know, and I remember vividly strutting down the street exactly and thinking like I had arrived. You know, I knew the secret now. And I did that every chance I could all throughout the rest of junior high and into high school and through high school. And, you know, that wasn't terribly often. I came from a semi-strict home. My parents had, you know, they had rules and limits and boundaries, and I wasn't allowed to just do whatever I wanted. So it was hard, you know, and I was underage. But I would, you know, make up stories and lie about where I was going and meet up with friends, and we'd get dropped off at the movies, or, you know, you say, oh, I'm going to spend the night at her house, and she tells her parents she's going to spend the night at my house, and then, you know, we spend the night at his house or whatever, you know, whatever we would do to try and, you know, get the homeless guy outside the checkway to, you know, buy us the Strawberry Hill or just whatever. And it was fun then. You know, it was fun. I had a lot of fun times. Only got into a few scrapes. You know, only embarrassed myself a couple times, really. There was maybe two fender benders, a couple groundings, one lost friendship. Nothing major, you know, nothing major. A bender, you know, around spring break or beach week that left me kind of shaky, thinking, okay, well, you know, I need to kind of, like, you know, chill out for a little while. But that was it. For the most part then, I was able to, you know, I was learning then to control it, I think, to control the intake. And I was able to control it and enjoy it for a while. I did okay in high school, and I went to college in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which is actually near Scrabble, which is how I came to get sober there. And it's in the tip of the Eastern Panhandle. So it's 5 hours from home, and this is before cell phones and internet and all that, and I was, like, far removed from the watchful eye of my parents and their rules, and so I was able to, you know, really party then, and I did. But, you know, like I said, I had kind of learned something about how to control my drinking, so, you know, I did want to do good in school, and so it was not, you know, my intention to just be a drunk, but I definitely wanted to get plenty of drinking in. So I kind of set it up and managed it so that I didn't take too heavy a course load, and I didn't have any morning classes, and I didn't really get a demanding job, even though my parents wanted me to, because, you know, I want to have plenty of time. I said to study, but really, you know, it's a party too. In college, you know, is where I really honed my drinking skills, and you know, that's where I started to figure out, okay, well, you know, I can last longer if I pace myself, or if I only have, you know, seven, that's like the magic number, or if I drink water in between each one, you know, or I would do like this thing where I'd reward myself. I can't go out until I study for this test that I have tomorrow, and once I finish studying, then I can go out, and you know, usually I was able to you know, say, I'm going to be home at this and such a time, and I would. Sometimes it didn't always work out, and I'd overshoot the mark and end up waking up somewhere I didn't want to wake up, but not enough that there were any red flags or glaring, obvious, you know, you have a problem, Courtney, kind of situations. So if you had told me then that one day I'd be, you know, going to an AA meeting and saying I was an alcoholic, I wouldn't have believed you, because I saw kids all around me that were having a hard time controlling their drinking and were flunking out of school and, you know, not showing up to class. And I remember, like, patting myself on the back because that wasn't me, you know. I knew how to hold mine. And, you know, and I used to think, too, that it was good that I had had a lot of experience in high school, because that way, you know, when, by the time I got to college and was on my own, I was able to, you know, kind of keep it in check like I needed to, so that I could get her done and function. And so I thought I was something for that, and I never would have believed that I could be an alcoholic. I thought that, you know, somebody who was destined to be an alcoholic was going to be an alcoholic from the get-go. And that's certainly, you know, I understand now that's a lot of people's experience. But it wasn't mine. You know, I did have a time where I controlled and enjoyed my drinking. You know, I like in the book where it talks about, you know, we're men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking, because that tells me that we could have had it at one point. And I had a really hard time accepting that you could be an alcoholic if you weren't always an alcoholic. And so when it talks about, you know, being a potential alcoholic or the real or potential alcoholic, you know, might start off as a moderate drinker, may or may not become, you know, a hard drinker, but at some point, you know, in his career loses all control. And that was my experience. And when that came about for me was after I graduated, 5-year plan, because like I said, I had to make sure I left plenty of time in there for partying. You know, this is where I start to see where my drinking did affect me, even then, because I had a lot of potential, and I could have gone on and done some pretty cool stuff. I had an opportunity to interview with, you know, our congressman, to work as a legislative aide in his office in D.C., and I turned that down because I knew that it would mean moving away from that college town where my watering hole and all my drinking buddies were. You know, which I wasn't ready to leave yet. I wasn't ready to leave. You know, I was graduating college, but I wasn't graduating the college drinking scene. I had no desire to grow up yet. And that just seemed like too much work and too much of a learning curve and too much of a challenge. And I wanted something easier so that I could just, you know, relax and have plenty of downtime. And so I didn't do that. I stuck around, and I just got a basement apartment and got a job that was way too easy, and shacked up with my college boyfriend, and we kind of just settled into, you know, going to our easy jobs and partying on the weekends. And that lasted for so long until it started to kind of get a little bit out of control. And I remember, you know, there's just a couple little things that made me start to wonder. Like, I started to lose control of my behavior when I was drinking. And I started to lose control of, you know, what I did, what I said, and who I did it with. And, you know, that was starting to, like, kind of disturb me. But always, you know, I'd say, well, I'll just do a better job next time. And I also was kind of embarrassed by our recycling bin and didn't want the neighbors to think that we drank too much. So, you know, there seemed always to be a lot of bottles in it, and it never was big enough. It was always overflowing, and I felt like I needed more than one. You know, but again, nothing huge and glaring and major. What happened was when I was about 25, I ended up getting pregnant as a result of too much tequila one night. And I can remember thinking, you know what, this is good. This is what I need, because it's time for me to kind of settle down and grow up. Other friends had moved away, were going to grad school, getting real jobs. I didn't seem to be doing that. We were living paycheck to paycheck and just partying there in the college town. And I thought, this is going to, like, motivate me to save up, put a down payment on a house, and get responsible and be a grown-up. And this is what I need. So this is a good thing, even though it wasn't planned. This is exactly what I needed, even though, you know, I was cheating on that boyfriend, getting drunk, running around on him, didn't like him. We were fighting all the time. It was real tumultuous. I thought, this will fix it. So And you know what? For a little while, it did seem to fix it. I did calm down. You know, I was a little worried that it would be hard to not drink for that the duration of that pregnancy, but it actually wasn't so bad. And again, I was patting myself on the back for that. And it was kind of a happy time, and I think it's probably because there was a lot less trauma and drama, to be honest with you, and also because I don't think that I had quite gotten to the point where I couldn't yet stop. We did move out of that basement apartment, and we did buy a little townhouse, and we started our little life together as a happy family, and had that baby, and beautiful baby boy, and I threw all of my neurotic energy into raising him perfectly. But the restlessness and the irritability and the discontent started to set in during that time. I had gone a long while without drinking, really. There was, some partaking during pregnancy and breastfeeding, but for the most part, I was good, and I started, after a while, to feel kind of like I was missing out, real dissatisfied with the way things had kind of turned out for me. A lot of my old friends, and I hung out with heavy drinkers, they were all still out there having fun, and I started to feel left out, and, my life wasn't enough, and, the walls were closing in on me, and he and I were growing apart even more. The baby didn't fix things between us, big surprise that was. And he was starting to really get on my nerves, I was thinking that I was just very unhappy, and I was very irritated being under the same roof with him, and I was very bored and listless, and this was the time when I decided that, mommy needed a little helper of an evening, and I think the real clincher was when I found out that my dad was diagnosed with lung cancer, and that happened right around this time. My son was maybe about 2, and I was realizing I was hating my life and my husband, and then I find out that my dad is, not going to be around much longer, and it really gave me an appreciation for my own mortality, and, I realized, life is short, Courtney, and you're only going to get one of them, and here you are, miserable. You need to do something different. And I wish I could tell you that I, sought a spiritual solution of some kind. But in a way I did, because alcohol had always worked for me to make me feel better. And I didn't like the way I was feeling. I hadn't really been turning to alcohol for a while, and I figured it was time now. He was older. He was out of diapers. He was no longer nursing, and he was sleeping through the night. I could go back to having a cocktail of an evening. And so I drove to the liquor store, made a conscious decision. I am just going to check out of this pain and uncomfortability, and the way I'm going to do that is to drink vodka tonics every evening. And I even had it all mapped out. I'm going to start at 5, so that by the time he gets home, I've taken the edge off and he doesn't get on my nerves as bad. And I thought it was foolproof. Because, I was thinking I was going to just manage and control it like I always had, and it would be fine and it would work and it would be enough. But for some reason, when I picked up, after that period of relative dryness, something had changed, something had shifted, and I don't know if it was my age chemically or what, or maybe it was just my time, potential alcoholic that I had been, but it was different, and when I started to drink, I couldn't stop then. I just couldn't, even if I meant to, and even if I assumed I would, and very quickly, one or two vodka tonics turned into 3 or 4, and then 5, and then the bottle's gone, and then I'm going out to the bar, and I'll see you later. And it just happened so fast, I remember. Probably that was when I was about 29. I came into AA at 31. So, it talks about in more about alcoholism, to be gravely affected, we don't always have to drink the quantities or for as long as some of us did, and this is especially true for women. The first time I read that, I remember being like, oh, wow, because that was another misconception I had about alcoholism, that you know, not only, you know, did you have to be an, you know, an alcoholic and drink like a pig from day one, but, you know, it couldn't just sneak up on you like that, you know, like, how did this happen? And the best way I can describe it is I think I felt like a caged animal all that time that I was semi-sober and really restless and irritable and discontent. And when I took that drink, it was like, oh, you know, the music, and it was like freedom. And I was just off running, and I couldn't stay contained anymore. You know, it wasn't enough to just have a few drinks to take the edge off. I had to go and, like, get relief from myself. I had to go to the bars. I had to paint the town red. I had to find people to pay attention to me, to see me. You know, I wanted that whole lifestyle. I wanted to just live hard and fast and have fun. And during this time, you know, we were going to therapy, counseling, couples counseling. We did that for 8 months, and it didn't work. And I remember thinking, well, you know, we've given it a good go at the therapy, so, you know, maybe this relationship just isn't meant to be. And at that point, you know, the cute young guy at the bar, I gave myself permission to go home with him, even though I was still married. And, you know, like, that's not the person that I was raised up to be. But I gave myself permission because I was unhappy. And if I'm unhappy and miserable, then everything that I do to make myself feel better is then justified, you know. Like, the ends justify the means. So, you know, I was able to rationalize it. Well, you know, he's an asshole anyway. You know, I don't have, you know, he deserves it or whatever. And so I started running around with this younger guy. I had a thing for bipolar guys. I don't know why or how. He was always like a musician, an artist, and bipolar, and had long hair. Always. And, you know, I remember, you know, that first night, like, you know, talk about a self-revealing account. Like, I was just so nervous, and I, you know, I didn't know what to do. So I had to get really, really, really drunk. And I remember there was a candle sitting on the floor. You know, the mattress was on the floor. Real nice digs. And just tossing, like, my shirt, and it caught on fire. My shirt was, like, disintegrated, and I had to go home with no shirt. And I remember being so scared, like, oh, my God, I'm busted. But I wasn't, and I got away with it, and I kept doing it, and I just my friend says, you took the cheap way out of the marriage, you know. I drank enough, and I partied enough, and I cheated enough that eventually I had to leave that marriage, because being married and doing that was, like, bothering me. It's kind of getting to me. So, I gave myself permission to leave, and then, you know, I could drink like I really wanted to because we had joint custody. So my son would go to him every other weekend and every other Wednesday and Thursday, and I moved in to, with my old friend from college who just got back from Peace Corps, where she had learned to drink whiskey with the local mafia till 3 in the morning, and every night. And so she was definitely a certain type of hard drinker, and we moved in together, and it was like perfect timing, because she introduced me to, you know, to you know, I guess, you know, all kinds of things, you know, like just different drinks and different ways of making it fun. And you know, she didn't really have much of a real job, and neither did I, because I'd been a stay-at-home mom, and I was still kind of looking for that perfect thing. And so we're just kind of running. We rented this old rickety house that was walking distance to our old favorite watering hole, and I just started, you know, living the alcoholic dream life, honestly. Parties every night, you know, always the kitchen was full of liquor, people were coming over. People were coming in and out. You know, it didn't matter that I had a 3.5-4-year-old. I thought that, you know, having lots of different artsy musician types coming in and out at all the hours, playing music and partying and being, I thought that that was going to, you know, that'd be like, you know, give him some culture or something. Make him, like, independent and kind of easily adjusted to different situations and lots of change and upheaval. And I started in this time, you know, to drink every day. This is the time when I started really, saying that I wasn't going to get drunk, but then getting drunk anyway. That had not really ever happened before to the degree that it was happening during this time. I did eventually get a job as a bank teller, and I can remember I had to be there early, like 8 a.m., and even on every other Saturday, I had to be there at 8 a.m., and I can remember saying, okay, I have to go to work early tomorrow morning. I am not going to get drunk tonight. I'm not going to end up with a hangover. I'm not going to be late. I'm not going to be sick the whole time I'm there. I'm not going to be sneaking off to the bathroom to throw up. I'm going to come home. I'm going to make dinner for my kid. I'm going to give him a bath, read him a book, tuck him in bed, and I'm going to get a good night's sleep, and I'm going to show up to work bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and do a good job, and that was my intention. And then, 5:30 would roll around, and I would get that itch and that restlessness and that irritability, and I'd be like, well, okay, I'll just have one glass of wine with dinner. But, for whatever reason, I couldn't just drink one glass of wine, even though I didn't even want to drink that one glass of wine. Once I drank that one glass of wine, it set off the phenomenon of craving that I would learn about later, and I had to have another and then another, and before I knew it, it was the same old, and what's the use anyway, and, I might as well get good and drunk now because it's already late, and we'll just make this one count, and then I'll do a better job tomorrow. And that just seemed to start happening almost every day. I don't know how I didn't lose that job. I was not a good bank teller. I was always coming up short or miscalculating almost every time, And I had a college degree, and you didn't even need one to have this job, And the head teller would always be like, I don't understand, I told you were overqualified for this job. I didn't understand why you're taking it. And now, you're the worst teller we have. And I was always so ill, customer service with a smile, forget about it. This was also the time, too, where I started to notice that I was doing things that didn't seem right. I made sure I always kept my bathroom immaculate, especially my toilet, because I knew I was going to be spending a lot of time hugging it later on. And I'd be cleaning my bathroom knowing this, and thinking, Courtney, this kind of, the fact that you have to keep your toilet clean, is this maybe a problem? And those little thoughts would pop up, and then I would quickly, shoo them away. I started to do things. We were talking on the way coming up here about, being raised in an environment where, you are given like a moral code, and you do kind of grow up with that, and you do learn what normal is, and starting to see that you're not following that, and that you're not living that way. And I started to see that, I remember one night I ended up sleeping with a married man, and I knew his wife, and they had little kids, and I knew them, and it was like, how did that happen? That is against my own code. I brushed off. He didn't like her anyway. It wasn't a big deal. I just won't do it again. And I started dating this guy who was 8 years younger than me. He was a college student and, again, bipolar artist. And I know business. Here I am, like a 30-year-old woman with a young child, and I'm traipsing around at the bars with like these college kids, and trying to recapture my youth and not grow up. And this guy, he was kind of tall, dark, handsome, kind of hipster type. And, he got a lot of attention from 19-year-old girls. They were the bane of my existence. I decided 19-year-old girls. And if you're competing with 19-year-old girls and you're 30, you're always going to lose. And he went quit cheating on me. He'd cheat on me, and I'd, fly off in anger, and we'd have this real big drunken tumultuous I'm throwing plates. We're having a Jerry Springer episode. And, he'd, leave, and then he'd come crawling back, after getting particularly drunk one night, and I'd take him back, and it kept happening. And some point my dad died, and the drinking got even worse, and I'm in this relationship, and I just, I'm slipping and sinking further and further down the drain, and I started to get, at this point, I started to get violent. And, he would cheat on me, and I remember, as an example, I couldn't not hurt him when I got mad. It was just like the fist came out, and, I remember one night being at a bar and being so drunk that I broke a bottle and came at him with it, and having to be subdued by the bouncers and thrown out. And I can remember thinking at one point, sitting in my kitchen and things have started to get unmanageable. I've started thinking I might have a problem with alcohol. And I'm sitting there with a glass in hand and a cigarette in the other. And it's 5:30, of course. It's always 5:30. And I'm thinking, man, here I go again. Is this going to be it? Is this how I'm going to just live for the rest of my life? Am I just going to be like 45 and doing this? Am I going to be the drunken lush mom? Am I going to be like this till I die, a daily drinker and a crazy drunk woman? And I mean, the answer that came to me was, yeah, you are. But so what? That's okay. Somebody's got to be that person. It's my line of thinking, that's just how I'm going to be. And I was okay with it. It was like, at that point, I think I kind of realized that I was an alcoholic, but I didn't want to do anything about it. I was all right being an alcoholic. My behavior when drinking was getting worse, and the violence ended up taking a turn that even I couldn't, shoo it aside or sweep it under the rug anymore. And what happened was, at the end of July 2007, he had cheated on me one more time, and this time I got really good and drunk on gin and vodka. I think I drank about 4 or 5 pint glasses full in quick succession on an empty stomach, and I got this grand idea that I was going to teach him a lesson. That's it. I'm not taking this anymore. I'm going to teach him. And I left my kid with my roommate and told her I was going to a party, and I snuck out and found 3 really large, rough guys that I knew, and convinced them to feel sorry for me and go and break into his apartment and beat the daylights out of him, basically, so that he would know that he had messed with the wrong crazy lady. And so that's what we did. And I could barely walk, but I, paraded up in there, and they took him and I took her. She was there too, so we were able to kill 2 birds, 1 stone, and that worked out nicely, I thought. And I had it in my head that I was just going to scare her and teach her a lesson. But I didn't tell her that, so she didn't realize it. And I was crazy and insane and scary, and I grabbed her by the hair and I drug her into the bathroom. And we did swim team growing up, and you always hear about, the boys would get hazed in the locker room, and the way they would do that was just shove your head in the toilet and flush. They called it a swirly. I had it in my head that I was just going to give her a swirly. That was it, And that would teach her somehow and humiliate her. I wanted to humiliate her. This is a 19-year-old girl who, was in her second year of college, and I drug her in there, and she just fought me with everything she had, and it didn't come off well, and she ended up getting the upper hand, and I got my butt kind of whipped, and they drug me out of there, and when we left, he was bleeding from his eyes, his ears, his mouth. He was in really bad shape, and they carried me out of there screaming like a banshee, and the next morning I woke up, sometime after 11, I was supposed to be at work, and I didn't understand why I was in so much pain, and then it slowly started to dawn on me. And that was the moment when, the 4 horsemen that it talks about, the terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair that really set in on me right in that instant. And I was like horrified by what I was, had done. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I can't keep doing this. And that was probably the worst day of my life, because I wasn't raised to physically injure people, you know, and I knew that that was wrong, and I felt terrible about it, and I knew that, like, the gig was up and that I couldn't drink anymore, that it wasn't going to be okay for me to go on like that. It scared me. It was loud enough and ugly enough that it woke me up to the fact that that this wasn't going to work, that I couldn't do it anymore, you know, and that I needed to change. And I think that was my first step moment. And within a week, I was going to an AA meeting. Now, I had been raised Presbyterian, and I was introduced to, like, the loving, kind of happy hippie Jesus, I was calling. You know, I didn't have this scary kind of punishing, judgment day, doom and gloom, fire and brimstone idea. Like, I was raised, that God loves you, and so I had a positive experience with that growing up. But somewhere along the line in my drinking, I don't know if it's, this is when I started leading the double life as a teenager. I quit going to church because it kind of felt like God was watching me and he wasn't too happy with how I was acting. And then we studied Darwinism at some point, I think, in high school, and I was like, oh, that's perfect. There's no God anyway. And so, you know, I neatly avoided that subject for a number of years. And, I was a pretty staunch atheist at this point. You know, I did not believe in any kind of, deity or creator whatsoever. And I even had a lot of, disdain for religion. And so when I looked up AA, when I Googled AA and found, some local meetings, I saw that there was one at a Presbyterian church, and I was like, well, I'll go to that one since it's in the Presbyterian church. At least it'll be like I thought that there, that we were affiliated with religion. I didn't know, and I really didn't want anything to do with it. I answered the 12 questions and got, 9 out of 12 answered yes, which it says if you answer 4 yes, you might have a problem, which seems a little bit excessive to me, but I don't know, why if you only answer 4 yes, you would bother coming to AA because it's not that bad yet. But I was just like, crap, I think I might be an alcoholic and I need help. And, honestly, I didn't think to stop on my own. I kind of just knew that I wouldn't be able to. I consider that today to be a gift, that I just, that I didn't even entertain any of my own ideas. That's not true. I did come up with one, and that was to maybe get pregnant. I thought that might chill me out and calm me down since it had sort of worked before. But at that point, there were no willing candidates. Nobody was returning my phone calls, even women. It was a small town, and I had acted really badly that night, and I was in a lot of trouble because they pressed charges. So I was charged with nighttime burglary, malicious wounding, and a couple misdemeanors. But those were some pretty, bad charges. And I thought it was a bit overkill. But, I think she thought I was trying to drown her. And I don't know why. I was only trying to shove her head under the water. But, so, I was scared. And I was scared. And I thought, well, I'll go to this meeting, and maybe they'll be able to tell me if I'm an alcoholic, and maybe they can help me chill out with my drinking a little bit, and maybe even I'll be able to, cry to them about my, new legal troubles, because nobody else was listening. But so I went, and I dragged myself in there, tail between my legs, and I got there a little late, and so I didn't hear the preamble, and I wasn't sure if I was in the right place, because it was a lot like this. I mean, everybody looked pretty good, and people were happy, and there was a lot of talk about God, But I didn't hear anybody talking about, the stuff that I was currently living. It was an open discussion meeting, and I don't know what the subject was, but I was like, these people are not like me. They are not like me. They have no idea. And I was thinking, I'm in the wrong place. This is like a homeowners association meeting or something. It can't be AA. You know, I thought you all were going to be like, when I walked in. But this woman turned and smiled, and she looked at me, and she, like, beckoned me in. And I'd never seen her before, and she was like, you're in the right place. And I remember thinking, like, how does she know? Like, how does she know where I'm even trying to go? And I listened, and at the end of the meeting, you know, everybody stood up, and I went to go leave, and she said, oh, don't leave yet. We're not done yet. And I was like, okay. So the next thing I know, I'm holding hands in a circle saying the Lord's Prayer, thinking, oh, my crap, I've landed in a cult. And I guess the look on my face said as much, because after it was over, she turned to me, and she said, is this your first AA meeting? And I said, yeah. And she was like, well, we're not a cult. And I was like, holy crap, this woman knows my every thought and move. And, you know, she asked me if I had a problem with alcohol, and I said, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic, but, you know, I know I'm in a lot of trouble because of my drinking. And she said, well, she said, it's not necessarily how much you drink, it's what it does to you. And I didn't know that. And that's the first time I'd ever heard anything like that, because I thought, you know, alcoholism was about quantity, amount, frequency, and that's it. Like, there's some formula you plug in, I have this many drinks, this amount of time, you know, and then poof, you either you are or you aren't. I thought, you know, because I didn't drink in the morning or all throughout the day, that meant, you know, well, maybe I wasn't an alcoholic. She told me to get a big book, and she asked me for my phone number. She didn't just give me hers. And she told me I might want to read some of the stories in the back of the book. And she introduced me to another woman who said, you know, because I started crying to her about all my troubles too. And she said, well, I didn't. She said, I didn't get into trouble every time I drank, but every time I got into trouble, I had been drinking. And that really, I really related to that, because I started to think back over my life and could see where any kind of trauma or drama, drinking was behind it. And so, I never forget those one-liners in the beginning. They meant so much to me, because that's what I could understand. I couldn't understand what you guys were talking about with steps and God and all that, but that kind of keep coming back, easy does it stuff, that I was like, you know, first drink gets you drunk. That stuff really resonated with me, and it still does. But so I went home, and I cracked open the book, and I did not take her direction and skip to the back, because I was an English major, and that's not how we read books. We start, you know, at the table of contents, and that's where I started. And I read, you know, the preface, and, you know, all the forewords, and the doctor's opinion, and, you know, Bill's story, there is a solution, more about alcoholism, and I got to tell you guys, I was reading about my life and myself, and I couldn't believe it. Because, you know, I saw that this was, you know, first printed in, like, 1939, and then it was a bunch of, like, you know, old geezers writing it, and, you know, somehow they got me, like, nobody else ever had, and it was almost creepy. Like, I was like, are they looking in my window, you know, because I kept reading myself in the pages, and especially more about alcoholism. And we agnostics nailed me, you know, that one really, I was like, oh yeah, you got me there. So, you know, I came back to another meeting, and, oh, and that woman called me too, and she encouraged me to come back. I didn't drink the next day. I did drink the following day, because I didn't go to a meeting like she suggested. Then I did go on that following Thursday, which was August 2nd, and, it was a speaker meeting, but it was a women's meeting that didn't have a lot of structure and usually no kind of message, I found out later. But for whatever reason, that day when I went, there was a woman there with 20 years of sobriety, and she shared her story for about 30 minutes. She told about what she'd been like and what happened and what she was like now, and, you know, it was my story. And I heard myself, and it gave me a lot of hope. And I went up to her after the meeting, and I was like, you know, I don't understand what any of this stuff you guys are talking about is with steps and God and all of that. All I know is, you know, I want to know, how do I go home tonight and not take a drink? I don't understand how I'm supposed to not take a drink, because I can't. I just can't not take a drink. And she looked at me, and she was like, you know, I guess you could tell I wasn't, like, about to go through the DTs. And she said, you know, you're not going to die if you don't take a drink this evening. And I was like, wow, she's right. I'm not going to die. You know, I'm just going to be uncomfortable, and then I'll get through it. And, you know, anybody else could have told me that, a doctor, my mother, anybody, and I would not have believed them. But because I had heard her story, I knew that she knew. And so I trusted her. And that's how I felt about everybody in AA. You know, I heard people talking, like, about me and how I thought and felt and believed and drank. And I saw that they were sober and happy and living, you know, fairly functionally. And I was like, you know, these people are on to something. And so even though I was really not so keen on the whole God thing, I was really desperate enough, and I wanted what you had enough to become open-minded. And so, you know, I got the 12 and 12, and I started reading the books, and I started calling people, and I went to as many meetings as I could. I would drag my little boy, and, you know, he'd be really disruptive and running around, and I got that home group and Scrabble. It was an Asheville season meeting, and I loved it. It was a bunch of old-timers, a bunch of, you know, bikers and Vietnam vets, and me, hardly any women, and he'd be running around like a little, you know, maniac, disrupting the meeting, making lots of noise, crawling under the tables, and nobody ever said a word to me about it. You know, they just were very kind and loving to me and to him, and very patient. And so I kept going back, and eventually, you know, I saw a woman that really had what I wanted, and I thought, you know, I need to get her as my sponsor, because I heard a little bit of her story, and it's really bad. So when it comes time to do my fifth step, she's not going to bat an eyelash. That's how I picked my sponsor, and she turned out to be a great sponsor. And every time I would call her with a problem, all she would do is share her experience and then refer me to whatever part of the book addressed whatever issue I had. And that was it. She never told me what to do. You know, she just encouraged me to go to meetings and to do the steps and, you know, to read the literature. And eventually, you know, it was hard in the beginning. It wasn't easy. It was real uncomfortable. I spent a lot of nights sitting up till 2 a.m., smoking lots of cigarettes, drinking sugary drinks, talking to people on the phone. I talked to so many people. I mean, that whole first year, you know, I was going through all the legal drama. And people probably got so sick of listening to me. And I remember that now when I have sponsees that are new in sobriety call me, and they're like going a mile a minute, and it's all crazy, you know, all this problem, that problem. And they can't seem to stick to one subject, and, you know, it can be overwhelming. But I remember that people listened to me probably too much. At some point I can remember my friend saying, you know, you just need to do the steps now. Like, I'm not going to listen to this crap anymore. And I'm thankful to him today for that. But, you know, I just did it one day at a time. And I was willing. And I was willing to, you know, be open-minded on the God thing and to start seeking and to start praying, even though I didn't think it would work. But other people talked about prayer, so that's what I did. And, you know, I did end up getting arrested, and I did have to spend a night in jail. My bond was like $50,000. It was insane. But, you know, my sentencing was the day before my one-year anniversary, and I ended up getting probation. And I spent that whole day sitting in that courtroom just praying. My sponsor told me, pray for the judge. Pray for, you know, the lawyers. Pray for the prosecuting attorney, even though you hate her. Pray for your attorney. And pray for everybody in the room, even the court reporter, and you will be okay. You will not be freaking out. And she was right, and that was true. And that girl who I had assaulted showed up, you know. I thought to see me burn. But I was on my ninth step then, and I knew I needed to make an amends to her, but I wasn't allowed to have any contact with her. And I thought, well, if I ask the judge for permission, he'll let me. And so I did, and he granted it. And when I turned to go give her the amends, she wasn't there anymore. She'd left. And, you know, I thought, whoa, I got all that one, you know, because, hey, I was willing. but what I know today is that it wasn't time yet, because I still in a lot of resentment towards her, and I know that I would have done it wrong. I would have probably brought up her part. And, years later, actually, it was pretty crazy. I was walking down the street in Charlottesville, like 4 years later, and she walked up to me out of the blue. She was living there, and I was able to give her an amends. And it was perfect timing because, you know, I had moved to Richmond. I moved to Richmond when I was 4 years sober, and I had gotten a new sponsor, and, you know, I had really kind of lapsed into kind of resting on my laurels for a while. And I realized that once I moved to Richmond because I was out of my element and I got in a lot of self-centered fear and got pretty crazy and needed to turn back to the solution. And so I was being taken back through the book, and it was perfect timing. And that was the moment where, you know, I was really in the solution. I was very surrendered, and I was given the opportunity then. And I think that was God. And I always spend too much time on my drunkalogue. It's already 6:53, and I wanted to go through the steps. But I will say this: when I moved to Richmond, I knew that I had stopped relying on higher power, and that's why I was in all that self-centered fear. And I can get there like really easily. And I am again today. I've been kind of like that all week, but I heard this woman speak on the 11th step, and I knew that I needed to get her as my sponsor. And, you know, I look back today, I look at that move. I moved because, you know, I was starting to get discontented again. It was a geographical, and I was feeling like, you know, there was nothing for me in West Virginia as a sober woman. I didn't have a fellowship anymore because I couldn't hang out really with my old drinking buddies as much. Not because they didn't want me around, but because I couldn't relate to them anymore. I had a spiritual awakening. You know, I was really transformed, and it wasn't the same. But there were really no peers for me in AA there. You know, it was a lot of you know, people who were, like, really honestly, like, 50 and older, and very few women, and it was small. It was small and rural, and so I was kind of isolated with myself a lot, and I didn't have that side of the triangle, you know, the fellowship, and I craved it, and I thought if I move to a place where there is bigger, there's more to do, and there are more people and more young people in AA, you know, I might get some friends, and that was my only intention, was just getting some friends, you know. And instead, I came here and I saw, and I landed at Jaywalkers. I moved to Bon Air. How perfect. I had no idea, but I landed at this meeting that was exactly what I needed at that time. And I saw all of these women who, some of them had not even been sober for as long as I had, and they were carrying a strong message. And I was like, wow, I am missing something. And it was a message that was in this book that had gotten me sober, you know. Because the AA where I was from really wasn't big book AA, you know. I got a spiritual awakening as a result of you know, taking the steps out of this book. But I didn't hear a lot about it in the rooms. A lot of open discussion meetings. And when I came to Richmond, I heard it all over again, and I heard people's experience with it. And I saw people really walking the walk and doing the deal. And a lot of stuff has, and I wanted what they had. And yeah, so I became willing again, and a lot of stuff has happened to me since I moved to Richmond. You know, I ended up getting pregnant again, not planned, wasn't drunk this time. I had a baby. Thank God they have childcare meetings in Richmond, because the toddler run it, it's a whole different ballgame. And, you know, that has been, that's been a ride, a lot of sleep deprivation, and a lot of hungry, angry, lonely, tired, but, and then my son's father died. He was killed in a car accident, a drunk driving accident. And I've had to go through, thank goodness I got with the sponsor that I got and went through the steps and had a new experience and reconnected with a God of my understanding, because I really came to have to rely on that during that time. But it saw me through. And I know that it works today because I have some reference to refer back to and see, you know. That old me that didn't want to be uncomfortable or do any kind of work, you know, or suffer through anything, that just wanted to escape, you know, either her unhappy marriage, her divorce, whatever it was, you know, that I didn't want to have to put up with. You know, she's being given the tools and the coping mechanisms Margaret and I were talking about on the, you know, we never developed those because I just drank my way out of every potential learning experience. And I went through that grief and I went through parenting my son through some really dark times. He ended up in a psych ward even at one point. And it all brought me to my knees, and but I got through it with, you know, with the spiritual solution that AA has given me, and that the steps provided me with. And that's not what I was looking for when I came. You know, all I wanted was just to stop drinking, calm my life down, and maybe get out of some legal trouble. And I got so much more. You know, I got to grow up, and today I carry that message. I sponsor other women. I don't know that it's quite an experience that I would not want to miss just yet. Nobody has stayed sober so far. But, you know, I'm learning a lot about myself. And it's a step more than any other, the 12th step, that is showing me myself, giving me an opportunity to grow. You know, forcing me to turn to my higher power, because I'm not trying to mess up anybody else's life. But I've run out of time. I'm really grateful for being asked to come and share. So thanks, Sam, and thanks, everybody, for listening. Yeah.